Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group. I'm joined by Omar El-Tarai, our Senior Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. Omar, it's great to be with you. What are we talking about today?
All right, so we have a number of reports and releases from the last week, including the FDIC's quarterly banking profile, a handful of economic indicators, including retail sales data, PPI, and consumer confidence, as well as the Federal Reserve's Beige Book. And we'll close the call out with the latest GDP Now read and some of the things that we're watching for next week. I'll kick this off with C's quarterly banking profile, which was released on November 24th. Some of the high-level kind of takeaways is that the banking industry in the U.S. reported strong third-quarter results driven by expanded margins and one-off accounting adjustment. The industry continued to shrink in terms of participants or the number of banks, but we did see good signs of growth in terms of the size of balance sheets and increasing lending activity. So net income totaled $79.3 billion in the third quarter. This is a 13.5 percentage point increase from the prior quarter. And return on assets, or ROA, rose to 1.27%. That's up from 1.13% in Q2. There were a total of 4,379 FDIC-insured banks in the U.S. That's 42 fewer than in the prior quarter and 138 fewer than a year ago. But this is one of the big trends that's been happening for many decades, is that the U.S. banking industry is shrinking in terms of count, but their balance sheets are growing. Another kind of encouraging shrinkage sign is from the third quarter is that the number of banks on the FDIC's problem bank list decreased by 2 to 57, and that represents about 1.3% of all U.S. banking institutions. If we were to look at the aggregate balance sheet and kind of liquidity trends, total assets across the U.S. banking system grew to $25.1 trillion in Q3. It's up about half a percentage point from Q2 and up 3.7% from a year ago. Total loans increased by $159 billion or 1.2% quarter over quarter to $13.2 trillion. Growth was led by loans and lending to non-depository financial institutions, as well as margin loans. That's an area that we can continue to watch, because I know that can be a little bit concerning or has drawn some skeptics' criticisms. Domestic deposits rose $92 billion, or about half a percentage point quarter over quarter. This marked the fifth consecutive quarter of growth. And deposit growth was driven entirely by estimated uninsured deposits, which rose 1.1%. The total loan to deposit ratio for the industry was about 67% at the end of Q3, which is just slightly up from Q2, shy of a percentage point up from a year ago. So that is kind of one of the first signs that these institutions are able to, they're putting that deposit funding to use. And unrealized losses on the security book decreased by $58 billion, which was down 14.7% quarter over quarter. This is the lowest level since Q1 2022 and was really driven by declining medium and long-term interest rates. If we check in on the kind of aggregate income statement for the U.S. banking system. The industry net interest margin expanded 9 basis points to 3.34%. That is surpassing the pre-pandemic average of 3.25%. Earning asset yields rose 11 basis points and funding cost increased only 2 basis points. So this is really taking all of this together, it's indicative that banks are effectively managing deposit pricing pressure. And then also on the income statement, provisions for loan losses fell by $9.2 billion, or a 30.7% decline quarter over quarter. This was a rather sharp decline and was driven by the absence of acquisition-related accounting charges, which were recorded by large banks in the prior quarter. If you were to strip out the anomaly of this accounting change, provisions would have essentially been flat. Now, this report is hugely helpful in looking at the banking system in aggregate. But given that you're tuned in on this podcast, I'm assuming you're interested in the commercial real estate takeaways. The high level trend is that banks are starting to get back into commercial real estate lending and are increasing their origination activity and increasing overall CRE credit. However, they're doing so gradually. And one of the reasons for that is because there are still some performance issues within the existing CRE loan book. So CRE loan growth was about 50 basis points in the third quarter compared to the second quarter, or 1.1% year on year. Overall, CRE loan balances across the U.S. banking system are just shy of $3 trillion at the end of the third quarter. Multifamily lending saw the strongest overall annual change in terms of outstanding balance increase at 3.14%, followed by the kind of broad category of non-residential, so non-farm, non-residential, which is pretty much everything that's not multifamily and still within that CRE space. And that portion of the CRE loan book grew at a 2.2% annual pace, while lending to construction and development contracted on both quarterly and annual pacing. While aggregate asset quality is generally stable for the entire loan portfolio across the U.S. banking system, inclusive of commercial real estate, the net charge-off rate is 0.61%. That's about flat quarter over quarter, while the past due and non-accrual, or PDNA, rates for non-owner-occupied CRE, multifamily, and credit cards remain well above their pre-pandemic averages. Digging into that kind of PDNA a bit more, banks with assets greater than $250 billion, so this is really the largest national banks, and many of which are universal banks as well, they reported non-owner-occupied CRE PDNA of 4.18%. This is pretty substantial. First, it's trended in the right direction because it did come down from the recent peak of 4.99% hit in Q3 2024, so exactly a year ago, but it does remain significantly elevated compared to the pre-pandemic period when the past due non-accrual rate was 59 basis points. So if you look at where it currently is in terms of the past due non-accrual rate at the largest banks being 4.18% compared to 60 basis points is substantially higher. Now, smaller banks and community banks, they are seeing a different trend. They didn't recognize significant levels of past due non-accrual CRE loans early like the large banks did, but they are seeing that continue to tick up. And you saw that kind of growing performance trend continue, albeit moderating slightly through the third quarter. So just to wrap it up, I would say that the bank balance sheets in the U.S. in aggregate look healthy and are gradually growing. They're showing signs of growing net interest margin and kind of profitability. You're also seeing growing loan-to-deposit ratios, which means that they are ultimately putting their deposit funding to use. But and this loan growth is true for commercial real estate, albeit slower than non-commercial real estate lending activity. And the existing loan book still has some issues in terms of performance, but it's not necessarily panic mode. And I think those performance issues are really part of the reason why the banks aren't piling into commercial at a much faster pace. But if the current trends continue, I would expect that kind of that pace and dipping a toe into commercial real estate, new originations and new credits to start to accelerate, particularly in a lower interest rate environment. Cole, I know that outside of the banking space, you were looking at a number of the recent releases. What did you see in terms of retail sales and PPI?
Yeah, we're still getting a couple of these to trickle in from earlier in the year because we had the government shutdown, which lasted a little over 40 days. And so we're finally getting some September data. But the two that we got last week on the 25th, I think are worth calling out either to confirm some stuff people have been suspecting over the last few months that we haven't had any data or to give us an idea of what to expect for the future. But the first that we got was retail sales. So again, this came out on November 25th. So it covers advance monthly spending on retail and food services. I mean, this rose 0.2%, or spending in those categories rose 0.2% in September 2025. That was the first release since the shutdown. Now, this followed a 0.6% monthly gain in August, but it did come in a little below expectations. I think economists were expecting about 0.4%. If you were to strip out automobiles, sales increased 0.3%. And then if you were to exclude autos and gas, rose 0.1%. So on an annual basis, though, spending looks a little stronger. Retail spending is up 4.1% on the year if you were to exclude automobiles. But that is still elevated over what we saw in the pre-pandemic period, which is if you were to average the growth rate from 2015 to 2019, there was an annual rate of 3.4%. Mind you that this spending is not adjusted for inflation, so something to keep an eye out for when we talk about these numbers. But I think the softer monthly readout is what most folks were focused on. We're seeing a little bit of a loss of momentum heading into the holidays here, even though this is, you know, a release covering September. But for the broader economy and for CRE, I think the slower pace of spending is a signal, and many folks were expecting a bit of slower consumer activity. It is widely expected for this to weigh on discretionary spending categories, limiting a lot of demand for retail and restaurant space. I know we'll wait for some of these figures to come out about Black Friday, but while the softer spending background could ease some inflation pressures, and that's going to have a big impact on what the Fed is going to do next week, although this is fairly stale data being from just a few months ago. However, the other piece of data we got last week was the producer price index, and this is a product of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So this also came out on the 25th, and it showed that producer prices or wholesale prices for final demand rose 0.3% in September. That's on a seasonally adjusted basis after a 0.1% decline in August. Now, most of the increase came from a 0.9% rise in goods. The price for services, on the other hand, was essentially flat. On an unadjusted basis, the index was up 2.7% over the last 12 months, and that was matching the annual pace that was seen in the August report. But something, and I alluded to this just a minute ago, but that is interesting about this report is that it was the first time since 2022 that goods inflation outpaced services inflation. So you've really seen that tick up since a kind of Liberation Day back in April. But inflation pressures remain pretty persistent at the wholesale level, particularly for goods. And in fact, they appear to be accelerating. And if firms pass these higher input costs through to consumers, you could see price pressures remain pretty elevated, again, complicating the path forward for interest rates and keeping borrowing costs high for CRE or even for development. But at a property level, and they do cover this data in the release, but you're seeing higher materials costs, and that's going to continue to weigh on construction pipelines and reducing NOI for incumbent owners. And I think that sectors that are most exposed to goods-related inflation are really going to start feeling this. But Again, September data that we've finally got after a six-week delay, but we'll have to see what shows up in the October and November reports as we kind of approach the holidays here. But Omar, that's some hard data that we got last week. We've covered this particular release a handful of times on the podcast, but I want to hear some of the qualitative data that you got. I know the Fed's Beige Book came out on the 26th. What were your big takeaways there?
Yeah, and it's funny that you say that the PPI data is being a bit stale. If we're telling yesterday's story with and catching up, the Beige Book, when it was released, one of the highest level takeaways is that not much has actually changed from when the data was turned on and flowing. So the November Beige Book was highlighting a lot of the same challenges and themes and takeaways and trends from the October Beige Book. So overall economic activity largely unchanged, with most districts really reporting little movement, though two did note modest declines and one of the 12 districts noted modest growth. Overall, consumer spending declined, negatively affected by the government shutdown, as well as the expiration of federal EV tax credits was also noted by a district. However, high-end retail spending was noted as remaining resilient. Manufacturing increased somewhat despite tariff troubles and headwinds, while non-financial services were flat to down. Residential construction and home sales varied across the districts, but some districts did see a recovery in terms of certain sectors of real estate. Notably, the office recovery is one that's been commented on for the last couple of beige books. And overall, the anecdotal expectations, again, remain unchanged from the last beige book in October, though some did report risks of slower activity being expected in the coming months. In terms of the overall labor markets, employment declined slightly, with weaker labor demand being noted in six of the 12 districts. Firms were generally limiting headcount through attrition, hiring freezes, as well as adjusting working hours instead of layoffs, though there were a number of districts that reported layoff announcements ticking up. And AI is still an area of focus and an area that is shifting and contributing to the softening within the labor market, particularly amongst entry-level positions. A bright spot in terms of the overall U.S. labor market is that finding workers has generally become easier, though shortages persist for skilled positions and immigrant workers. And also kind of a bright spot would be that wages were reported to have grown at a modest pace. That's a win for the worker, but a cost for the firm. And that kind of feeds into the fact that many districts reported total labor costs facing upward pressure, not only from shortages, but then also from rising health insurance premiums. On the price front, and looking at kind of a key theme for prices, prices rose moderately during the period. Input cost pressures were widespread, particularly in manufacturing and retail, driven largely by tariffs. Costs also rose for insurance, utilities, technology, and healthcare. And many firms reported margin compression or financial strain due to the rising price pressures that they're encountering. And in terms of anticipated price movements going forward, they're upward cost pressures are expected to persist, though there are plans to raise near-term prices by some of the business contacts, but not necessarily by all. I feel as though some of that color, we can see that in other kind of quantitative data. You know, I think the overall kind of macro picture or the national picture reported in the November Beige Book was one of kind of the same themes we've seen earlier this year. Now, in terms of commercial real estate, I thought the themes were again, similar to the prior period, but we did get new color on them. So one of the major CRE themes from the November beige book was the data center boom. So construction and demand for data centers are a primary driver of CRE activity across multiple districts. This was noted by Cleveland, Atlanta, Chicago, and San Francisco. But on the other end of the spectrum, or those that aren't seeing as much activity, would be the Boston district, which they noted that power constraints within that district are really making it so that Boston is missing out on this data center boom. Another major theme for CRE from the Beige Book has to do with the office market bifurcation and stabilization. So while high vacancies are persisting in some regions, including Minneapolis, several districts reported stabilization within their office markets. They're seeing declining vacancies, as well as this continued kind of flight to quality and Class A properties. So this was noted in the Boston, New York, Richmond, Atlanta, and Dallas commentaries. In terms of sticking on the theme of property sectors, many districts noted that they're seeing some softening within the multifamily market. So there's been a pretty distinct cooling trend across apartments. Districts are reporting moderating rent growth coupled with slowing absorption and increasing concessions being offered by landlords. This kind of multifamily softening was reported in Boston, Richmond, Atlanta, Kansas City, and Dallas. And then on the construction front, and this ties back to some of the data that we were seeing in the FDIC quarterly banking profile, is many large commercial projects are struggling to get financing and funding, whether that is uncertainty around the project itself or just lenders not providing financing. And so that means that if there is the construction activity that's been reported is predominantly shifting to renovations, conversions, and specific high demand sectors like data centers. And that was seen pretty much across the country. I think the Beige Book is, you know, a little bit of a bias because I do find this to be a very helpful in terms of color, but it is qualitative. And when we do get that kind of little change being seen, and that's what's being reported, it makes it a little bit harder to compare to itself. This is one that we'll continue to focus on and report on. Cole, moving out of the qualitative space and back into the quantitative space, were there any other data sets or data releases that you were paying attention to that might help paint the picture for the start of 26?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a couple of private data releases that are a little bit more timely since we're waiting on some of that government data to catch up. And this will be a bit of a callback to the retail sales figures, but I wanted to mention the Consumer Confidence Index. This is not to be confused with the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index, which will actually come out shortly after you're here in this podcast. But this is another figure that came out on the 25th of November. And this is November data from the CCI showing that index fell 8 to 88.7, which was a sharp decline from the month prior at 95.5. This is split up into a couple of indexes. You have the present situation index, which reflects how consumers view current business and labor market conditions. And that actually slipped to 126.9. Now, the really interesting one here is the future kind of expectations index. That declined much more sharply to 63.2. And that is the 10th straight month below the level that often signals recession risk, which is 80. Now, there were a couple of things noted in the report that I think add some color to a couple of the other things we've been talking about. Consumers are concerned about job availability. They're becoming more concerned about income prospects. And they are just generally more cautious heading into the holiday season. Again, this is November data that was surveyed just at the end of the month. I think the broader takeaway is that there's a big decline in confidence. Households are possibly going to reduce discretionary spending. I'll be interested to see what this looks like for the month of December. But you're going to see pressure to retailers, hotels, restaurants, in the event this competence actually translates into action or lack thereof. So I think if it does, the kind of essential retail or value-oriented concepts are going to be the ones that hold up better in this environment. But again, we got to see if consumers actually react the way they say they are. I think you often get people who think things are broadly bad, but personally fine. And that translates to the kind of raw data on spending being an aggregate, not super bad. So consumers are reassessing their spending plans nonetheless, at least according to the survey. And it does kind of reinforce some of the other hard data that we got about the cooling consumer backdrop. And I think that's something that we should watch out for heading into the holidays now. But Omar, I think you looked at one last release of data this week. We haven't covered this one in a while, and I think we are missing a GDP readout for Q3. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the latest results from the GDP Nowcast from the Atlanta Fed.
Yeah, so as of December 1st, the Atlanta Fed's GDP Now model is estimated that real GDP growth for the third quarter is 3.9%. What's notable is that this has been trending down over the last week or so, or last couple weeks, falling from 4.2% on November 21st to 4% on the 25th, and then to 3.9% on the 26th, where it's effectively remained. This downward trend in the estimate is really being driven by predominantly one thing, which is manufacturing weakness. So the drop from 4% to 3.9 was following the release of the advanced manufacturing data. And this is something that I think is important to watch, given that it's certainly going to be considered by FOMC members if we have this kind of still inflationary but contracting or slowing growth environment and this kind of dearth of data due to the shutdown. You know, if you're listening to this podcast, the next update to the GDP Now model will be coming out today on December 4th. I'm taking the GDP Now model into consideration as well as the market's pricing of interest rate cut movements as we go into the final Fed day of 2025, which is happening on December 10th. We saw a massive swing in the CME's FedWatch tool showing that the market moved from kind of 50-50 split on whether or not the Fed would be cutting on the 10th to almost near certainty. We're back up around 90% probability that they expect a cut. But that being said, you know, we've seen those expectations swing. We've seen GDP Now forecast really swing substantially. And so I think this is all going to be hopefully resolved, or at least a little bit more stable in the periods to come. But also a final kind of call out would be that with the Fed's interest rate decision, they're also releasing the summary of economic projections on the 10th, which this will really show where the FOMC members are expecting real GDP growth, inflation, and policy rate movement through 2026 and beyond. Cole, what are you watching for in the coming week?
Yeah, we've got a handful of things next week. You just mentioned Fed decision is on the 10th, but the Tuesday, the 9th, we'll get a couple of pieces of data that I think will also be closely watched. We'll get the NFIB Small Business Optimism Index, in addition to their Small Business Economic Trends report. That's on the 9th. In addition to the JOLTS survey, or the Job Openings and Labor Turnover survey, that'll come out at 10 a.m. on the 9th as well. But Omar, I know you have an article that'll be up on the Altus website soon that folks might want to check out. What's in that one?
Yeah, so this will be a summary of the capital markets, the economy, and commercial real estate activity through the third quarter. It's a kind of a supplement or complementary piece that is paired with our Investments and Transactions Quarterly report, which is also out. So yeah, I would encourage you to check it out.
Okay, cool. If you listen to our last episode, you'll be familiar with a lot of the content in there, but it's a lot more visual. If that's the way you like to consume some of the recent data, we'd love for you guys to check it out. But Omar, I think that's all the time we have today. But before we sign off, I just want to encourage our listeners, if you like the show, we'd love it if you could rate it. Please give us 5 stars on Apple or Spotify and leave us comments there as well. We'd be happy to read them. Or feel free to just send us an email at altusresearch@altusgroup.com. We'd love to know what topics you've covered on the program. But in the meantime, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you all on another episode of CRE Exchange. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.